22. The Emperor of the Earth. The great ruler, aroused by great thoughts, strode mightily about his night study. Music swelled within him. An enormous brass band provided the accompaniment to his march. Discontented, eh? Let them be. They always had been discontented, and they always would be. But Stalin had a passing acquaintance with an uncomplicated version of world history, and he knew that given time people will forgive all bad things, indeed forget them, or remember them as good. Whole nations behaved like Queen Anne in Shakespeare's Richard III. Their wrath was short-lived, their will infirm, their memory weak, and they would always be glad to give themselves to the victor. The crowd was, as it were, the stuff from which history was made. Make a note of it. It shrank in one place only to swell in another. So there was no need to treat it gently. The reason why he had to live to 90 was that the struggle was not over, the building was not finished, the times were uncertain, and there was no one to take his place. He must wage and win the last world war. Exterminate like gophers the Western social democrats and all persistent pests throughout the world. Then, of course, he must raise the productivity of labour. Solve all those economic problems. In short, build communism, as the phrase went. In that context, by the way, completely incorrect ideas had entrenched themselves. Stalin had thought it over recently and reached clear conclusions. Naive and short-sighted people pictured communism as a kingdom of plenty, of freedom from necessity. But that would be an impossible social order. At that rate, communism would be worse than bourgeois anarchy. The first and main characteristic of true communism must be discipline, total subordination to authority, and strict execution of orders. The intelligentsia must be kept under particularly firm control. Second, plenty must be modest plenty. Not even sufficiency, in fact, because over-prosperous people fell into ideological disarray, as could be seen in the West. If a man does not have to worry about food, he escapes the material pressure of history. Being ceases to determine consciousness, and everything is topsy-turvy. So when you came to think of it, Stalin had built true communism already. This could not, however, be announced, or people would be asking, where do we go next? Time went on. The whole world was in motion. One had to have somewhere to go. Obviously, it never would be possible to announce that the communist society had been built. That would be a methodological error. Now there was a man for you, Bonaparte. He was not frightened by the barking of Jacobin Yard dogs. He declared himself emperor, and that was that. There was nothing bad about the word emperor. It meant commander, the man who gave the orders. That was in no way incompatible with world communism. What a splendid ring it would have. Emperor of the planet. Emperor of the earth. On and on he marched, while the brass bands played. Some day, maybe, they would discover a preparation that would make him alone, immortal. No, they would be too late. But how could he abandon humanity? To whose care could he leave it? They would get in a muddle, make mistakes. Very well, then. He would build more monuments to himself, bigger ones, higher ones. Technology wouldn't stand still. Erect a statue on Kazbek. Erect a statue on Elbruz, with their heads always above the clouds. And then, so be it, he could die, the greatest of the great. None was his equal. There was no one in the history of the earth to compare with him. Suddenly, he stopped. On earth, yes. But what about up there? He had no equal here, of course, but what if you raised your eyes higher, above the clouds? What about there? He began pacing again, but more slowly. This was the one doubt that sometimes insinuated itself into Stalin's mind. On the face of it, the facts had been proven long ago, and all objections refuted. All the same, there was some obscurity. Especially if you had spent your childhood in the church. if you had gazed into the eyes of icons, if you had sung in the choir, if you could chant, "Now lettest thou thy servant," right now without a slip. Just lately these memories had for some reason become more vivid in Iosif's mind. His mother, as she lay dying, had said, "It's a pity you didn't become a priest." He was the leader of the world proletariat, the unifier of Slavdom, and in his mother's eyes a failure. Just in case, Stalin had never spoken out against God. There were plenty of orators without him. Lenin might spit on the cross and trample it. Bukharin and Trotsky might mock. Stalin held his tongue. He had given orders that Abakadze, the inspector of seminaries who had expelled the young Djugashvili, should not be harmed. Let him live his life out. And when, on July the 3rd, 1941, his throat had dried up and tears had come into his eyes, tears not of terror but of pity for himself, it was no accident that the words that forced their way from his lips were "brothers and sisters." Neither Lenin nor any of the others could have uttered those words, intentionally or otherwise. His lips had spoken as they had been accustomed to speak in his youth. Nobody saw him, nobody knew, he had told no one, but in those first days he had locked himself in his room and prayed properly, except that it was in a corner without icons, prayed on his knees. The first few months had been the hardest time of his life. At that time he had made a vow to God. If the danger passed and he survived in his post, he would restore the church and church services in Russia and would not let believers be persecuted and imprisoned. It should never have been allowed in the first place. It had started in Lenin's time. And when the danger was over, when Stalingrad was behind him, Stalin had done all that he had vowed to do. Whether or not God existed, only God knew. Most probably he did not, because if he did, he was extraordinarily complacent and lazy. To have such power and put up with it all, never once interfere in earthly matters. How could that be? Leaving aside the deliverance of 1941, Stalin had never noticed anyone but himself making things happen, never felt anyone at his side, elbow to elbow. But suppose God did nonetheless exist. Suppose he had power over souls. Stalin must make his peace before it was too late, in spite of the heights he had reached. His need, in fact, was all the greater because of that. Because there was emptiness all about him. No one beside him, no one near him. The rest of mankind was somewhere far beneath him. So that God was, perhaps, nearer to him than anybody. And also lonely. It had given Stalin real pleasure in recent years that the church, in its prayers, proclaimed him the chosen of God. That was why the monastery of St. Sergius was maintained at the Kremlin's expense. No great power's prime minister got such a warm reception from Stalin as did his docile and doddering patriarch. He went as far as the outer door to meet the old man and put a hand under his elbow when he took him in to dinner. He had even been thinking of looking perhaps for some little property, a little townhouse of some sort, and presenting it to the patriarch. People used to make such gifts, to have prayers said for their souls. Stalin knew that a certain writer was a priest's son, but concealed the fact. He had asked him, when they were alone once, whether he was Orthodox. The man had turned pale and lost his tongue.
"Come on, cross yourself. You know how?"
The writer had crossed himself, thinking that he was done for.
"Well done,"
said Stalin, clapping him on the shoulder. There was no getting away from it. In the course of a long and difficult struggle, Stalin had occasionally overdone things. It would be nice to get together a splendid choir and have them sing over his coffin, "Lord, now lettest thou thy servant." In general, Stalin had begun to notice in himself a curious predilection not just for orthodoxy. Now and again he felt the tug of a lingering attachment to the old world, the world from which he himself had come, but which he had now spent 40 years destroying in the service of Bolshevism. In the 30s, for purely political reasons, he had revived the word motherland, obsolete by then for 15 years and almost obscene to the ear. But as the years went by, he had begun to take genuine pleasure in using the words Russia and motherland. It somehow helped to put his own power on a firmer basis, to sanctify it, so to speak. In earlier days he had carried out party policy without counting how many of those Russians were expended. But gradually he had begun to take more notice of the Russian people and to like them. A people that had never betrayed him, had gone hungry for as long as it was necessary, had calmly faced all the difficulties, even war, even the camps, and never once rebelled. They were devoted. They were pure in heart. Like Poskrebyshov, for instance. After the victory, Stalin had said quite sincerely that the Russian people had a clear mind, strength of character, and staying power. In fact, as the years went by, Stalin's own wish was to be taken for a Russian himself. He found some enjoyment, too, in playing with words reminiscent of the old world. Instead of school heads, let's have directors. Instead of command personnel, let's have officer corps. Instead of all Union Central Executive Committee, Supreme Soviet. Supreme was a very fine word. Let officers have orderlies. Let secondary school girls be educated separately from the boys and wear aprons and pay for their special lessons. Let every civil service department have its own uniform and marks of distinction. Let Russians rest like all other Christians on Sunday, and not on nondescript days that were just numbers. Let only legal marriage be recognized, as under the Tsar. Never mind that he himself had once paid dearly for it, and never mind what Engels thought. And although he had been advised to shoot Bulgakov and burn his white gardist play The Days of the Turbines, some power had jogged his elbow and he had written, "Performance permitted in one Moscow theatre." Right there, in his night study, he had stood before the mirror to see how old-fashioned Russian epaulets went with his tunic, and had enjoyed doing it. In the last analysis, there was nothing intrinsically objectionable about a crown as the highest mark of distinction. The old world, after all, was a tried and tested world, a stable world that had lasted 300 years. Why not borrow what was best in it? At the time, the surrender of Port Arthur could only gladden the heart of the young Stalin, a revolutionary on the run from exile in Irkutsk province. But after the defeat of Japan in 1945, he had told a bit of a fib, claiming that the surrender of Port Arthur 40 years earlier on had always been a stain on the pride of older Russians like himself. Yes, yes, older Russians. It was no accident, Stalin sometimes reflected, that the man to establish himself as ruler of that country and win all hearts in it was Stalin and no other, not one of those illustrious loudmouths or pointy-bearded Talmudists, people without kin, without roots, without substance. There they were, there they all were, on his shelves, unbound, in pamphlets dating from the 20s, those who had choked on their own eloquence, been shot or poisoned or burned, died in car crashes or committed suicide. Removed from all libraries, declared anathema, excluded from the canon. But there they all were, lined up for his inspection. Every night they offered their pages to him, wagging their little beards, wringing their hands, spitting at him, shouting themselves hoarse, yelling out from the shelves, "We warned you! You should have done things differently!" Nitpicking was easy. You didn't need brains for that. The reason why Stalin had assembled them there was to sharpen his temper at night, when he had decisions to make. Somehow it always turned out that the opponents he had destroyed had not been altogether wrong. Stalin listened cautiously to those hostile voices from beyond the grave, and he occasionally adopted some of their ideas. Their conqueror, in his generalissimo's uniform, with his low, retreating, pithecanthropoid brow, shuffled along the shelves, clawing at his enemies, grabbing now one, now another, reordering their ranks. The invisible band that had accompanied his marching played a few false notes and stopped. By now his legs were aching and threatened to give way. A heavy surf pounded in his head. The chain of his thoughts slackened and snapped. He had quite forgotten why he had gone over to the bookshelves. What had he just been thinking about? He sank onto the nearest chair and buried his face in his hands. A dog's life. Old age. Without friends. Without love. Without belief. Without desire. Even his beloved daughter was useless to him. A stranger. The feeling that his memory was impaired, that his mind was growing dim, that he was cut off from all living beings, filled him with impotent dread. He looked around the room with clouded eyes and could not have said whether the walls were near or far away. On the occasional table near him stood another locked decanter. Stalin felt for the key, which was attached to his belt by a long chain. When he was feeling faint, he might drop it and take a long time to find it. Unlocked the decanter, poured, and drank his stimulant. He sat for a while with closed eyes. He began to feel better in himself. Better still. Quite well. His eyes cleared and fell upon the telephone, and the thing that had eluded him all night wriggled through his memory again. He caught a brief glimpse of it, like the vanishing tip of a snake's tail. There was something he should have asked Abakumov. Whether Gomulka had been arrested? Aha! That was it! He rose, shuffled over the carpet, reached his desk, took a pen and wrote on his desk diary, "Secret telephone." They kept reporting that the best experts had been brought together, that they had all the necessary equipment, that morale was good, that there was keen competition between teams. So why couldn't they finish it? Abakumov, damn his insolence, had sat there a solid hour, the dog, and said not a word. They were all the same in every department, every one of them out to deceive his leader. How could they possibly be trusted? How could he ever take a night off? His breakfast was still more than 10 hours away. He rang for his dressing gown. His country could sleep, free from care, but there was no sleep for its father.